This programming is sponsored by Linscombe Wealth, a wealth management firm partnering with individuals and families dedicated to helping them build, preserve, and manage wealth by creating a customized plan to work toward achieving their goals. More at linscombewealth.com.
This programming is sponsored by the Near Northwest Management District, located just off 290 and the 610 Loop, with a mixture of modern and mid-century homes providing families room to grow. More information at nnmd.org.
Welcome to our Texas edition of Party Politics, a podcast to prep you for all things political in the Lone Star State. I'm Jay Iyer, a political science professor from Texas Southern University.
And I'm Brandon Rottinghouse, a political science professor from the University of Houston. Thanks for joining us this week. And on unfortunate note, we have some bad news coming out of Texas, and that is yet another mass shooting. So, Jay, what happened there?
In the small suburban community of Sutherland Springs, kind of outside of Bexar County in the San Antonio area, we had a lone shooter. It looks like now from the preliminary reports from law enforcement that it might be related to domestic violence. He was an Air Force veteran who was with a history of, I think, anger and mental health related issues. Somehow was able to illegally obtain a weapon, or I guess legally obtained it because the Air Force had not notified law enforcement that he should not.
26 people dead, 20 wounded, and a small town just in tatters. And we're heartbroken that this has to keep happening. The legislative response will be of interest, I think, because we know that in some of these grave moments that the legislatures, either in Texas or potentially at the federal level, can make some changes. You said, I think, something that a lot of people have been talking about, and that is the need to have the crimes related with mental health to be put into the FBI's database when people are checked to see if they're eligible to have a weapon. By law, they're not allowed to, but it is completely mishandled and has been a real problem. And of course, now we see the implications to these kinds of mistakes.
Yeah, Brandon, I think in an earlier podcast, you and I had talked about some of the laws that were passed this past session. And my understanding was is there's a specific law that took effect in September that allowed churches to have private security. Mm-hmm. Is that not the case?
Yeah. And part of this question gets at something that I wanted to ask you, and that is that there's this kind of thesis that people should be armed and that can stop these kind of events, what the FBI calls a good guy with a gun. I went and looked to see if this was true. Now, the FBI had a report on active shootings between 2000 and 2013. What they found was that more than half, 57%, were terminated by the shooter who took their own life. 26% ended in law enforcement engagement with gunfire, and that ended up killing that person. And 13%, the shooter was successfully disarmed or restrained by unarmed civilians. And 3% of the incidents had a shooter being confronted by armed citizens, four of whom were on-duty security guards, and one person was just what they call your kind of average good guy out there who happened to be carrying a gun. So the good guy with a gun thesis, or even somebody who's there at the church to guard it, isn't the general ending of these kinds of things.
No, that's absolutely right. The data doesn't support it at all. It's important to recognize that in mass shooting situations, the idea that a individual can stop them if they're in fact themselves armed is just not true. And that's not taking away from anyone's individual right to bear arms in terms of protecting themselves, but just the reality of the way mass shootings occur, I think it's a mistake to make that assumption.
And the legislature and the U.S. Congress can do more to be able to stop these kinds of things from happening. Now, clearly, they're not going to make a lot of progress on, like, you can have guns or not. That is not a dichotomy that we're going to consider. They need to be able to make sure that these kinds of mistakes don't happen. And that's something that's been really hard to pull together, even after, you know, two major shootings in a row.
Brandon, you just mentioned mental health being a factor. And I know here in Houston, we had an issue where there's been, I think, a change in the punishment that was given to a criminal at the request of the district attorney in Harris County, and mental health was really at the core of it. What happened there?
This is an interesting question. Yeah, so the Supreme Court essentially invalidated Texas' method of determining intellectual disability for death row inmates. Basically, the cutoff is if you were considered intellectually disabled if your IQ was 70 or below. And what had happened was that Bobby Moore, who was on trial and had been convicted murder, was essentially on death row, and was that sentence was kicked back because it was the case that this process was found to be incorrect. Now, the Harris County District Attorney, Kim Ogg, who's been very progressive on death penalty kinds of issues, has asked the appeals court to essentially reduce that sentence to life in prison with the impression that she wouldn't essentially pursue the death penalty in this case, and has asked them to create a more fair and clear standard that's based on kind of medical issues as opposed to just sort of this arbitrary distinction.
Kim Ogg has been sort of a leader in terms of changing the face of criminal justice, at least on a modern basis. She's been sort of on the leading edge when it comes to reform as it relates to marijuana use and drug use in general, and certainly has been in favor of, I think, reforms on bail system in Texas and now dealing with the issues of folks who are intellectually disabled. And this is just another example of a DA that I think is moving forward in a way that's unconventional.
Yeah. It's interesting because the death penalty and Texas were so associated for so long together, right? But
now, and Harris County in particular.
Yeah, really. It was really the epicenter for so much of the controversy about the death penalty. And now it seems like they're moving in the opposite direction. So this is yet another sort of example of how there's been a real kind of progressive movement on criminal justice. And that's really started in Texas. So it's kind of interesting and potentially ironic, right, considering the state's past. So, Jay, we have some interesting and very salacious news coming out of Austin. We have a burn book for the Texas legislature. Tell us about it.
So a group of legislative staffers, for the course of several years, have put together essentially a Google spreadsheet, a Google document that outlined incidences of sexual harassment that were occurring by members of the state legislature, elected officials, campaign workers. I think the real context of this has been going on for a while, but it was brought to light in light of the larger issues that we're seeing in society and the recognition that this is something that is no longer going to be tolerated. The Daily Beast had done, I think, a pretty large story on this, but I think we're really at the tip of the iceberg when it comes to this, because this is an issue and a problem that seems to be permeating every level of society. And many, in the case of this one, many of the individuals here are Democrats, self-described progressives, who frankly have been very quick to criticize when other people have been accused of this.
There is a sense that the Texas legislature has always been this sort of old boys club. In fact, Bob Bullock was famous for a statement to Senator Zaffarini, and she said he told her that she could get any bill passed if she cut her skirt off at 6 inches and put on some high heels. That was in the 90s, which you think was an eternity ago. But even as recent as 2013, reports suggested that Lois Kolkhorst and Duana Dukes were having a debate over an amendment, and there were literally catcalls and meowing during that debate. And this is completely unacceptable, right? In a modern legislature in a state like Texas that's supposed to be sort of setting the standard for what the nation is to do. So this is something that definitely needs to be exposed. We need to be careful about sort of who is and who is not on this list, because these get into some, you know, sticky legal issues, but it is not acceptable behavior. Potentially by exposing it, there's an opportunity to be able to call it out and make that more routine. And I think that's really what's important about this.
This is something that has occurred and something that was frankly tolerated in the past. It's in every aspect and it needs to be ferreted out. And yeah, it's efforts like this that I think are going to do that. And hopefully that can change the overall culture of our politics. Brandon, we had an election this past week. A lot of statewide amendments, propositions were on the ballot. They passed. What struck you with that?
Wow. Well, the first thing that struck me was that people seem to not really be that involved in the voting process.
I'm shocked,
right,
to hear that.
Thin as a gnat's whisker. Only about 6% turnout statewide, Jay, which is almost at historic lows. All of the propositions did pass statewide. The one that came closest to not passing was Prop 7, which allows for financial institutions to award prizes to customers to encourage savings. That passed at 60%. This is something that the state struggles with. There are so many people who are underbanked or unbanked in Texas, and this was designed to basically encourage people to sign up to have savings accounts.
Right. This is the proverbial toaster amendment, right?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, back in the day when if you sign up for a new account, they'd give you a toaster. At least that was what they showed you in the 50s and 60s on TV.
Yeah.
But yeah, this is sort of a return of that, kind of the rewards program.
Now the students, like, they ask, you know, what's a checking account, right? Like,
yeah, exactly. Right?
They've got Bitcoin and they've
got Venmo, and they're doing everything electronically. So, you know, the idea of starting an account is just seems so old-fashioned.
Right.
Well, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about this past election here in Texas and looking ahead to 2018, because we finally are seeing some movement on the Democratic side of the ledger.
So, Jay, we just talked about through the 2017 elections, and as it always is the case, there's another election right on its heels. 2018 is shaping up. We've got all the statewide officials who are up, and things are starting to come into focus. We have Austin attorney Justin Nelson, who's announced to run as a Democrat against Ken Paxton for attorney general. Kim Olson, a retired colonel, who is running against Sid Miller for ag. You've also got Lupe Valdez, who's the sheriff of Dallas County, considering running for governor. In the mix in all of this is some of these congressional seats. Ted Poe has said that he's not going to run again. That makes essentially the third Republican in a week to say that he's not running. So what does the lay of the land look like to you? Democrats have a chance in the statewide seats. Are we looking at some possible pickups for them in these congressional seats? What's your take?
On the Democratic side for governor, for example, we've got a couple people talking about it. Andrew White, the son of former Mark White. We broke that story here on the podcast.
Breaking news.
That he is, I think, all but certain to run for governor, where he is sort of taking a view of running as a sort of centrist Democrat, and where he was less than, I think, pure in the traditional sense of many yeah. Democrats saw and wanted. You saw a movement to try to get someone else in the race who was more progressive than Andrew White. And then Lupe Valdez has emerged. She's an interesting candidate if she chooses to do it, and there's a lot of sort of arguments for it. She was elected to her fourth term back in 2016. She'd be the longest-serving sheriff in Dallas County history if she completes the totality of her term. She's also in sort of in the twilight of her political career. She's 70 years old. She's a Latina. She's the first openly LGBT person who was elected in Texas, certainly at a large level. So there's a lot of historical firsts for her. So it kind of makes some level of sense for her to say, you know what, there's probably not a lot of opportunities going forward for me to run. This might be an opportunity to do so. I'm not sure ultimately if she does. I think in many ways, her getting in the race is really a position against left-center kind of split in the Democratic Party.
Yeah.
That's what that's about. Lieutenant Governor, you've got Mike Collier running on the Democratic side. You know, he ran for state comptroller before, kind of a steady person, has, I think, a good resume, not a whole lot of money, not a whole lot of prospects, certainly against the bombastic Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick. The AG race to me, and I think you and I have talked about this, I think that is the most winnable race for a Democrat potentially. Mm. Justin Nelson is a successful trial lawyer with the law firm of Sussman Godfrey, a large firm. He's well-heeled and well-connected. Ken Paxton has a lot of legal issues himself. That might be one where there's a chance. Kim Olson, a similar situation, running against Sid Miller, who is he's literally a walking controversy. On the down ballot side, there might be some opportunities. Greg Abbott is just a tough nut to crack. I mean, he's got that massive war chest, the most popular elected official statewide right now. Whoever runs on the Democratic side is going to have a big mountain to climb. And we haven't even mentioned that Ted Cruz has, of course, a challenge from Beto O'Rourke, the congressman from El Paso. And so you've got the makings of a race. You might see some changes at the local level, but I think the Republicans, by and large, are still in pretty good shape here statewide.
I think so, too. Lupe Valdez is a good candidate for the Democrats for a couple of reasons. I think the first is that she's got history with Abbott, and so that is going to spur turnout because people want to see that battle. And high turnout is critical for Democrats, period, but especially in an election where turnout is so low, right? If we get to 35%, it'll be a groundswell. So Democrats need people to come out. They need a high-profile person to run specifically against Abbott, not just somebody who's a good, big Democrat, but somebody who can take on Abbott. The fact that she is a female Latina also suggests a couple of important things. The first is that we know that female candidates at the top of the ticket allow for success for female candidates at the bottom of the ticket. So that could potentially boost the success rate of Democrats who are finding females to run in a lot of these seats, especially congressional seats. The other is that we know that a Latino or Latina at the top of the ticket boosts turnout in heavily Hispanic districts and heavily Hispanic counties. So that's a real boost for Democrats as well, if they can get the Latino vote to wake up and to show up. And that's going to be the real difference maker. Let me ask you this, because the problem for me is that she is also openly gay, and she has battled with Abbott on Sanctuary City's issues. So there's a likelihood of her being painted as a kind of one-note candidate the same way the Republicans did for Wendy Davis, right? That she's basically pro-abortion and that's it. Of course, that's not it. There's a lot to a candidacy. But you have most people in the state strongly oppose Sanctuary Cities. Almost 56% of people say that they think that that should not be the policy. And people don't really understand it that well, right? But they don't think it should be. And the Democrats are going to be on defense with her potentially. So if that's the case, do they have a better shot or worse shot?
Well, I think she probably ultimately would be a less successful candidate against Abbott than Andrew White would.
You think so?
Right. And largely because, I mean, if you look at the Delta or sort of the area where you have to be able to tackle the vote, you have to get people who voted for Republicans to vote for Democrats. They're largely sort of suburban Anglo voters. And you would think just based on the profile of Andrew White, particularly from a business side, and some of the issues he wants to emphasize, property tax reduction, things like that, that he might have a chance of actually doing a little bit better there. That being said, he won't probably benefit the down ballot at all, because essentially it's going to be a candidacy built around a suburbanized kind of strategy, not a base strategy. So Valdez could find herself in a situation where she fares worse on a one-on-one matchup, but she makes it possible for the down ballot to be more successful. The straight ticket Democratic vote could certainly go up.
Yeah.
You could also see greater possibilities for, as you say, individuals running for state rep and state senate, and maybe U.S. Congress in some cases. So I can see the advantage there. She could inadvertently or consciously sort of benefit the rest of Democrats, but probably won't be governor herself.
Is it the case that the Democrats are shooting themselves in the foot by making sure that their candidates are like the prototypical liberal slash progressive?
The Texas Democrat brand has seemingly gone away. It's sort of been synonymous now politically in a similar way to sort of national progressive politics. I think the mistake that Texas Democrats make is not recognizing that the vast majority of Texas voters, not necessarily Texans, but Texas voters, are still continue to be sort of right of center. And so unless you have candidates that can appeal to that spectrum of current voters, your only other alternative is to dramatically increase the makeup of the voters. And so unless you can get folks who think like you to come out to the polls, you're going to have to deal with the folks that are actually the ones coming out. The center of the Democratic Party is not necessarily the center of the Texas voters.
Yeah, and we know that because polarization is in full effect, that if you can't get a stimulated Democrat to come vote, then you're not going to win the election. That's especially true in Texas. So they need somebody who looks like a Democrat to come vote. But at the same time, they're potentially cutting off people who might otherwise vote with the party who don't represent or don't believe the same things that all the Democrats believe.
Well, we're going to take a quick break, and we're going to tell you why this means so much to you.
So we talked a bunch about the lay of the land in 18 here in Texas. What does this mean to people?
What people have been talking about for a long time here in Texas is whether or not we're ever going to be a two-party state, whether we're ever going to be competitive again. This might be sort of the stirrings of that. I think it's part of a longer-term project. Might see more changes by 20. But I think by 22 is when you'll really start to see some Democrats break through. You might see it on some of the down-ballot races like AG, like ag commissioner, but by and large, this is a process for Democrats, and this is just kind of the opening innings of the ballgame.
I think the thing to watch here are whether or not you can find the Democrats picking up a couple of seats in a midterm election, right? That's the hardest thing to do, because that's really when, like, you eat. You set the table in a presidential and you feast in the midterm, and that's the way that Republicans have made tremendous strides in Texas and nationwide. If the Democrats can't make that same pattern happen, then it's going to be really hard for them to be able to turn Texas blue.
Well, we'll be back next week with more party politics. If you like this political chatter, make sure to check out our national politics episodes too. They're available every Friday afternoon, just like these episodes. This show wouldn't be possible without the help of Houston Public Media, our super producer, Edel Howland, and our engineer extraordinaire, Todd Thor Hulslander.
Hey, leave us a review on iTunes because it'll help other people find the podcast. Any questions? Shoot us a tweet with the hashtag PartyPoliticsPod or email us at PartyPoliticsPod@HoustonPublicMedia.org.
I'm Jay Iyer.
And I'm Brandon Roddinghouse. We'll see you next week.